I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Midday. Are you bewildered by arguments over No Child Left Behind, Race to the Top, Common Core, high-stakes testing, unions, charter schools, teacher tenure, and a public education system that always seems in flux? Our guest in this first hour of the show, journalist Dana Goldstein, reminds us that we've been arguing about teachers for two centuries and fighting over the same thing. In fact, she argues, teaching has always been the most controversial profession in America's political and cultural universe. Today's debates, she says, have their genesis in a 19th century movement that envisioned teaching as a safe, genteel profession for impoverished single women who didn't need much training and would work for peanuts. Why teaching continues to be America's most embattled profession on Midday after the news. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Midday. Dan Rodericks here. Thanking you again for making Midday part of your day. If the eighth graders in Anne Arundel County feel a bit wrung out by standardized testing, it's understandable. According to a story in the Sunday Sun, they'll undergo about 46 hours of standardized tests mandated by the state and the county school boards before this year is out. And that doesn't count the normal tests and quizzes that teachers traditionally give as part of their lesson plans. Not surprisingly, many teachers and an increasing number of parents in Maryland and across the country are having second thoughts about the national emphasis on high-stakes testing. It's just one flashpoint in an ongoing drive to make schools and teachers accountable for their students' progress. Our guest in this first hour of Midday says that this is part of a debate that has been going on in various forms for about two centuries, through wave after wave of reform, as the U.S. tries to determine what its teachers should be, how to treat them, and how to measure what they do. In her new book, aptly titled The Teacher Wars, journalist Dana Goldstein calls public school teaching the most controversial profession in America and notes that today's debate has its roots in the early 1800s, when a wave of socially minded reformers decided that strict, curmudgeonly male schoolmasters should be replaced, ideally by impoverished single women more attuned to the needs of children, women who needed little training, and incidentally, women who could be paid as little as possible. Dana Goldstein says this has led to an historic under-evaluation of teaching as a profession. Undervaluation. Unlike many other developed countries where the job confers more status and often much higher pay. For example, the average experienced American teacher who is responsible for the education and welfare of children for 6 hours a day made $54,000 a year in 2012. That's compared to $70,000 for the average dental hygienist. In an even-handed and very readable narrative, Dana Goldstein describes the educational fads that have come and gone under different names since the days of Horace Mann, battles over federal funding, the lingering effects of segregation, the vilification of teachers' unions, the growth of high-stakes testing, and what she calls an almost pathological obsession with statistics and metrics. Dana Goldstein grew up in a family of public school educators in a small town outside of New York. A graduate of Brown University, she's written about social science, inequality, criminal justice, women's issues, urban affairs, public health, and now public education. Her work has been featured in Slate, The Atlantic, The Nation, The Daily Beast, and other news outlets. Currently, Dana is a staff writer at the Marshall Project. That's a nonprofit focused on criminal justice issues. Her new book, which we recommend if you have any interest at all in American education, is entitled The Teacher Wars, A History of America's Most Embattled Profession. It's available from Doubleday. Dana Goldstein, thank you very much for joining us here on the Midday Show in Baltimore.
Thank you, Dan. I'm really pleased to be with you.
There's enough material in your book for 6 or 7 hours of Midday. So, you know, I know where I want to begin. I could begin back in the 19th century with you. We can touch on that history a bit. There's a lot there. It's a rich history. But if you don't mind, I want to start in 1983, because I'm very interested in where we are today in this age of accountability for teachers and high-stakes testing, as I mentioned. I want to go back to something, a title of a report that I haven't heard since, I don't know, maybe in 30 years. I haven't even thought about it. A Nation at Risk, this report that came out during the Reagan administration. The Reagan administration. You call it in your book one of the most influential federal documents ever published, A Nation at Risk. If you don't mind, let's start there and remind our listeners what A Nation at Risk was.
The reason A Nation at Risk was so important and really set the terms of the education reform debate that we're still having today is because it used American children's scores on tests like the SAT to put forth an argument that our schools were failing in comparison to our peer nations, places like Japan, Russia, Germany. And this, you know, it should sound familiar to our listeners today. It's really how we still talk about schools today.
Because this was the beginning of the movement for national standards and accountability, that word accountability in education. And so a lot of people agreed, yeah, we need that. We need metrics and data to see how our schools are doing.
Yeah, and one of the useful things about standardized tests and one of the things that it has shown us that I would argue is good is that we have increasingly been able to see how are our Black children doing compared to our white children? How are our Latino immigrant kids doing and our kids with disabilities? So it is important to have some sorts of metrics so that we can compare groups of students to each other and we can know where we do need to do better.
So would you say that that report we mentioned, A Nation at Risk, that came out in the Reagan administration, that's the root of No Child Left Behind, for instance, and now we're at something else called Race to the Top?
Yeah, absolutely. The sort of ideology of if we increase our testing, that will lead to improvement. That I think we can trace back to A Nation at Risk, but particularly A Nation at Risk put forth some ideas for solutions. And some of them I write about in the book. I think the idea that we need more learning time, so potentially a longer school day, a longer school year, that was one idea. It suggested national curriculum standards. We're still sort of struggling and debating whether that's something we're comfortable with as a nation, as the Common Core debate makes clear. But they also said in this report, A Nation at Risk in 1983, that teachers were failing, that American teachers were mediocre, they were uneducated, and it laid quite a lot of the blame for this situation on teachers themselves.
And then, but we're still doing that, aren't we? I mean, with No Child Left Behind, there came this idea of an accountability for school, for each school, individual schools, and the principals in charge of them. But basically, it fell on the shoulders of teachers.
Right. So with No Child Left Behind in 2001, the George W. Bush administration, they really saw collecting test scores as a way to hold schools accountable. But President Obama shifted that. You know, he was less interested in the school as the locus of control, as the individual teacher in his or her individual classroom. And what President Obama did is that he required states, if they wanted to get big federal grants, to promise to evaluate every single teacher, no matter what grade or subject they taught, by their students' performance. And that typically means by the student score on a standardized test.
Mm-hmm. You know, one thing we can't leave out when we talk about A Nation at Risk in the beginning of this national standards and accountability movement in education is the idea that if you could improve the outcomes for students, you'd have better individual students. They would achieve better standards of living. They could, you know, have better jobs, live better, and rely less upon welfare growing up and benefits from the government.
Yeah, I mean, the argument has been put forth since the 19th century and certainly over the past 30 years that education is a key fix for inequality and for poverty. And one of the reasons I wanted to write this book was to look at the history and social science and try to come up with an answer to that question. You know, what role does public education and public school teachers play in fighting poverty? How realistic is it for us as a society to expect that we can come up with solutions to those problems primarily through the use of teachers in schools?
Mm-hmm. So where are we today, would you say? I mean, I know that's a big question. Are we all on board with national standards? I guess we're not because of the controversy stirred by Common Core. That's the latest term that we have to come to an understanding about. you know, this idea that we need to have national standards, metrics, a way of measuring, or else it's all a big it's a big mush, and we can't tell actually how we're doing, how our tax dollars are being spent.
Yeah, so Common Core, of course, are the national pre-K through 12 curriculum standards in math and reading, and they were driven by a group of nonprofits, by the teachers' unions, by the Gates Foundation, by some of the organizations like the College Board that create standardized tests. And they created these standards and they went state to state asking state legislatures to sign on to them. One of the reasons why so many people who normally disagree with each other about education came together on the Common Core is because No Child Left Behind required states to create standardized tests for kids in third through eighth grade, but it let states decide what would be on those tests. And what we saw is that, you know, a passing grade in Maryland was a lot harder to achieve than a passing grade in Mississippi, for example.
Mm-hmm.
So the Common Core was really meant to address that. And I've done some writing about the core and have looked at the standards themselves. And I think actually the standards are excellent. What's become so controversial with the Common Core is the tests that are attached to them, the standardized tests that kids have to take. Because as you mentioned in your intro, kids are already taking so many other types of quizzes and tests. And this is all tied up with the teacher accountability debate, because the hope with the Common Core is that we would create these tests and then kids' scores on them would be used to evaluate, judge, hire, fire teachers. So the Common Core is not separate from the teacher accountability debate. It's actually all part of it. And both on the right and on the left, there's increasing movements against the Common Core, critical of it, parents who are angry about too much testing, teachers who feel it's not fair to be held accountable so quickly for a new set of standards that they may not have had the opportunity to really become familiar with yet.
Right. When I ask that question, I wonder where we are today, because I get so many different messages here. Every time we talk about this on midday, we get some people who call in and say there's too much testing. Teachers are assigned to just teach to the test, and that's not good for our children. Other people say, well, you have to have standards somehow. You have to be able to measure the outcomes somehow. So I think testing is good. But who's driving this now? I'm a little confused on who's driving the accountability thing, because what I hear is more of the former, that there's too much testing, that there's too much teaching to the test.
I mean, the answer of what's driving the accountability push and the Common Core and these new ways of evaluating teachers using student test scores is that it's something that the Obama administration has incentivized states to do. States, two-thirds of states pass laws in response to those incentives. And separately from the philanthropic sector, we have big funders like Bill Gates, the Walton Foundation, which is connected to the founders of Walmart, the Broad Foundation, which is connected to the real estate businessman Eli Broad. These organizations have come together to sort of boost the federal response through their philanthropic giving. So that's why all of this pressure came down all at the same time.
But are we figuring out, what do you sense now? We're figuring out that we can't improve education just by adding more tests?
We can't improve education just by adding more tests. I mean, there's different types of tests. So a big end-of-year standardized test may be interesting to gather sort of longitudinal data that you look at over the course of, say, 5, 10, or even 20 or 30 years. But what really helps teachers do a better job in their classrooms are tests that they themselves make that are connected to the curriculum that they're teaching in the class and mm-hmm. that they can take home at the end of the day and grade. And the reason why that's so helpful for both students and teachers is because then the teacher can see, have I successfully taught these kids what I want them to learn? And if not, I know right now at the end of the day, and I can change what I'm doing tomorrow in response to that. And that is the sort of most powerful testing. That's the sort of testing that drives improvement in our peer nations. This idea of high-stakes standardized tests at the end of every single school year, it's really an unusual one in the Western world. A lot of nations have experimented with this in the past, but not a lot of nations stick with it over time, because the more high-stakes testing you have, there are perverse incentives. The curriculum gets narrowed to focus on what's on the test. There's a lot of evidence about that. Sometimes, as in Atlanta, there's cheating scandals where adults take the answer sheets. They erase the wrong answers and correct them because they're going to get paid more if they do that. Of course, that's rare, relatively rare. But the curriculum narrowing is a much more serious concern, and we know from research done since No Child Left Behind that that really is happening. If you only test in certain sorts of ways, teachers are going to focus on what's on the test. And that might mean less time for science experiments, field trips, art, music, and all of those other things that we care about.
Yes. And one of the things that I've thought about, I'm not a teacher, but I've thought about this, is how does a teacher, if there's so much focus on these tests, the high-stakes tests, how does a teacher determine what their students do and don't know, do know and don't know? You know, it seems to me that that gets lost in the individual students.
Yeah, it's hard to know from a high-stakes test often what your students do or don't know in the time period you need to make decisions about your classroom. Because, of course, the kids may take the test in May and you may get the results in September, and guess what? They're not your students anymore.
Right.
Yeah, so these sorts of high-stakes systems have not really been set up to drive improvement, and that's what we're looking for. We're looking for improvement.
Dana Goldstein is our guest in this hour of the show. We welcome calls and comments about this subject here on Midday. Today we'll take our first break. Dana Goldstein, her book is The Teacher Wars. We're going to talk to her about the title of this book when we get back. A History of America's Most Embattled Profession. A short break on Midday. If you want to reach us for a comment or question, 410-662-8780. Toll-free long distance, 866-661-9309. And welcome back to Midday. Dan Rodericks here, Dana Goldstein, our guest, the author of The Teacher Wars, A History of America's Most Embattled Profession, a very readable, concise history of American education trends, an explanation of why so many reform movements have come and gone and have failed, and some of the things we can do to restore faith in public education. We'll get to that during this hour. About the title, I think it's aptly titled, your book, The Teacher Wars, because the teachers are always in the middle of this.
Yeah, and some people ask me about the title, and what I like to say is that I wanted to explain the teacher wars without engaging in the teacher wars, which is quite challenging because it is such a high-octane, sometimes nasty debate. But the reason why the title is historically apt is if you go all the way back to the 1830s till today, you'll notice that controversy after controversy in American life, whether it's over Catholic immigration in the 19th century, the immigration of Eastern and Southern Europeans in the early 20th century, racial equality during the Civil Rights Movement, and today socioeconomic and class inequality, each of these major debates in American history, teachers are really put in the center of it. And there's very high expectations always for teachers to solve these problems. Sometimes those expectations are unrealistic, and this leads to this this warring that I document in the book.
You know, the idea of low expectations from teachers, you know, you say it has its roots in the 19th century. We ought to go over some of that history here. This is really interesting for anyone who's ever wondered why through the 19th century and in the 20th century, so much of teaching was in the hands of women more than men. Tell us a little bit about how that came about, Dana.
One of the surprises in my research for the book was that in 1800, 90% of American school teachers were male. And then by 1900, the vast majority, over 70%, were female. And of course, today in 2014, 76% are female. So that feminization that happened in the 19th century has been consistent. And there's really two reasons why the profession becomes a female one. The first is that an argument is put out that women are more moral, that just as the mother is suited biologically to be with the child in the home, the thinking went at the time, the teacher is almost biologically suited to guide the child's moral education in the school. And it relates to the idea that was prevalent in the 1830s among folks like Horace Mann, the founders of the Common Schools movement, that we weren't educating children with academic knowledge or to be intellectuals, but the point of our public education system was to create moral adults, really this idea of character education, which we talk about a little bit today, but not as much anymore. That's become less what we talk about in terms of the point of schooling. So there's an ideological argument for why women will be better at this, that they're more pure. But secondly, there's an extremely pragmatic political reason why policymakers prefer female teachers, and that is because of wage discrimination. You can pay them 50% as much as men. So if we're going to make schooling compulsory in the 19th century, we're going to require parents by law to enroll their kids in school, then we really need to have women teachers because this is going to make this much cheaper for the taxpayer.
And women, maybe women who aren't married, women who have been widowed in
particular,
right?
Yes, because the assumption and the hope even is that these women don't need a living wage because they don't have a family to support. They're just on their own. By the end of the 19th century, some research is done on this, and it turns out, well, a lot of these women teachers, they were supporting family members. They were single mothers. They had elderly relatives they were supporting. There was an out-of-work sibling. I mean, these were working-class families that these teachers tended to come from.
So I'll push up the clock on you a little bit. So by the time we get to, say, the middle of the 20th century, later in the 20th century, there are, I don't know, seem to be more men, only because, I guess maybe at the high school level. But there were efforts made to train teachers, right, to actually send them to these normal schools, state colleges, to prepare people for careers in education.
Yeah, the normal schools begin as teacher training schools in the 19th century, and they're at the time an alternative for high school. So you would finish maybe seventh grade and you would go into the normal school, and it would be 1 or 2 years. You might take some pedagogy classes, and you may or may not have the opportunity to student teach during that time. That was not at all a given, just as it's not a given today. Not all teachers student teach, which a lot of people don't realize. But those normal schools in the 20th century evolved into many of today's non-selective regional state colleges. And so it is true that the academic qualifications of today's typical public school teacher are pretty mediocre. They have a little bit below average SAT scores, average GPAs. And this is something that causes a lot of anxiety in the reform conversation.
So they didn't draw or attract the best students, but there were efforts to do something about that, right?
Yeah, I mean, we often think of Teach for America today as the program that started in 1989 on Princeton's campus and has been successful in drawing some of our most elite college students to teach for 1 or 2 or 3 years, in part because it only requires them to do a 5-week summer training. It puts them straight into the classroom without a lot of practice. This is not the first time in American history we've tried this. President Lyndon B. Johnson had a program called the National Teacher Corps. It was a great society program in the 60s and 70s. It was modeled on the Peace Corps. It was very similar to Teach for America. It had some differences in that it required the teachers to actually live in the poor neighborhoods where they were teaching. It asked them to do volunteer work in those neighborhoods related to poverty issues. So in a way, it was kind of a more lefty radical program than Teach for America, but it had a similar model. And then similarly, in the 19th century, there was something called the Board of National Popular Education, which was all about getting Protestant, East Coast, well-bred types of girls to go open one-room schoolhouses in the frontier West. And the reason why those girls were being recruited to do that, again, it was not about academics or being an intellectual. It was all about teaching those kids the right values and morals. And those teachers who did that, they didn't just open one-room schoolhouses. They also taught Sunday school.
Mm-hmm. So it's almost like missionary work.
Exactly.
You know, I was just thinking about something. There aren't many colleges anymore that call themselves teachers' colleges, right? A lot of them jettisoned that name, abandoned that designation.
Right.
But, you know, we go to medical school, University of Maryland Medical School. They're not ashamed to say this is a medical school or a dental school or a law school. Do you think it says something about education, the status of a career in education, that we don't have those designations at our colleges?
Well, certainly a lot of the teachers' colleges now call themselves education schools or education programs, and part of the pressure on them has been to actually grant PhDs in education, sort of on the research of education, in addition to just forming teachers. And this is part of the problem, which is that less and less of the focus at some of those places is actually on getting teachers ready to be in the classroom. And oftentimes they're being taught by people who themselves have not taught K-12, or they taught K-12 so long ago that they hardly remember.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the evolution of some of these teachers' colleges, as you say, into today's education programs that grant PhDs has sometimes taken the focus off the pragmatic sort of day-to-day skills teachers need to impart content knowledge to students, and equally important, to manage a classroom and deal with issues like student discipline.
And there were teachers' unions formed. There were battles with teachers and teachers' unions. By the time we get to the Reagan era and that report that we started talking about at the beginning of the show, A Nation at Risk, the nation is kind of primed for this kind of accountability, right? Because teachers have a reputation of being not engaged, of being generally mediocre, having the summer off, all those things that we—and having powerful unions to protect them, all those things.
Yeah, so the teachers' unions begin in 1897, but it's really not until the early 60s that they win collective bargaining rights, which is, of course, the right for the union to represent those teachers in formal negotiations for contracts with school districts. And as teachers gain power with their unions, the unions become less and less popular. And when teachers go on strike in the 60s and 70s for higher pay and more classroom autonomy, this can lead to resentment, in part because teachers are perceived as fighting for their rights at the expense of poor children in particular, that, you know, when the teacher gets paid more, maybe there's less money to spend on other aspects of schooling that could help kids. I think there are some significant flaws to that argument. Teachers' unions have advocated for a lot of policies like universal pre-K that are very helpful to poor children. But this is the sense there is a lot of anger toward teachers' unions. And, you know, only 7% of American private sector workers are unionized. So when the typical American looks at teachers who have tenure protections, it's very hard to fire a senior teacher. Teachers have generous pensions, generous health care programs. A lot of people say, well, I don't have that. Why do teachers deserve that?
410-662-8780. If you'd like to join our conversation with Dana Goldstein, author of The Teacher Wars, A History of America's Most Embattled Profession. We really like this book. Let me read you a comment that's on Facebook about testing, because I think that subject's going to be something we talk about a lot during this hour, and we'll take some calls, Dana, okay? This is an interesting comment from Amy talking about the high-stakes testing that goes on in our schools today. She says, it is not an effective teaching process unless all you want to teach is how to do well on a specific test. Generally, testing simply shows the economic status of the students' parents. It almost always correlates. And the only ones who are getting a good return on their investment are education corporations who get fat testing and curriculum writing contracts from states and local jurisdictions. What do you think about that?
Well, she's right that there is generally a strong tie between a student's socioeconomic status, their family's income, and how they do on a test. But it is also true that good teachers can drive improvements on tests and improvements in learning, even among the poorest children. And that's a point that I make quite strongly in the book, that there's overwhelming social scientific evidence that the best teachers can drive improvements, even among the most struggling kids.
A comment by email that you'll find interesting, given what we were just saying about the teaching profession and its history. Susan says, the only thing my mom ever discouraged me from being was a teacher. This surprised me because she highly valued a good education, and her own mother was a school teacher in the early 1900s. Over time, I realized what a poor deal teachers have had as a profession. That's a very interesting comment. Mm-hmm. Our email address, by the way, folks, is midday@wypr.org. Let's take some calls. Go ahead, Dana. Did you want to say something?
I was just going to say I often hear that people's family members who are teachers tell their own kids not to become teachers.
Yeah.
And what's inspiring to me is that often the kids don't listen to that because they're so passionate to do the work. And, you know, among the 3.4 million American public school teachers we have a great many excellent ones. And even with the mediocre pay, and I always just like to make that point.
You might as well just mention in here, you come from a family of educators. I mentioned that. Can you just tell us a little bit about them?
Yeah, sure. My maternal grandfather taught in vocational high schools in New York City public schools, and my dad was a public school teacher and then an administrator in New York State. He's retired now.
Okay, thank you very much. Let's go and take some calls, Dana, and then you can comment here. We'll start with William in Annapolis. Thank you for calling Midday. Go right ahead, William.
Hello, Dan. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, fine.
Okay. Yeah, this is fascinating to me. My father's second career after being a big band musician was education. And I'm calling because I'm firmly in the camp of paying teachers a better wage. I have my father's original contract from 1958. This is a man who graduated from USC with a master's in education, and he was contracted, and he taught for at least 15 years junior high in California. He started at $3,500 a year.
1958, you said?
Yes. Even in 1958, if we were in the middle income, we were at the very lowest bracket of middle income.
Yeah. Well, Dana, you touched on how we got that way. The history is there. And today, when you look at the U.S., the way we pay teachers compared to other professions and compared to other countries, you heard me cite the example of dental hygienist pay as comparison to comparison to teachers. How do we stand in terms of the Western world? In terms of teachers.
So if you actually look at the raw income of our teachers, they don't make a lot less than teachers in other countries. But here's the catch. We have a lot more inequality in our labor market than other nations do. So, for example, an American teacher earns only about half as much as an American engineer. But in South Korea, an engineer and a teacher earn a very similar salary, and a teacher earns only a little bit less than a doctor. Mm-hmm. So the typical college student who's considering public school teaching in the United States economy is facing a much harder decision to become a teacher. And so for that reason in the book, I argue pretty forcefully for looking at how we structure teacher pay. The starting salaries are way too low. Teachers have to wait way too long and work many decades before they can achieve an upper middle class salary. We certainly have upper middle class expectations for the job, but that's not reflected in the pay.
Here's another call. Dana, this is Dawn in Parkville. Welcome to the show, Dawn.
Thanks, Dan. I'm a college teacher over at Towson University. In a lot of ways, I feel like I'm trying to fix what was not done early on. But despite that, I have great skepticism a lot of the proposed reforms. And there are three points I'd make. One goes back to 50 years ago, and I recall my cousin's husband who taught high school talking about having a parent-teacher night, being there for 3 hours and saying he didn't see any of the parents he needed to see. So I wonder, where's the accountability for parents in all of the education reform? I don't hear that, only holding teachers accountable. Second, the students I teach at Towson, they tell me they take these tests and really they don't care about the results because it doesn't mean anything to them. So at that point, I wonder, what exactly do the tests show in terms of the performance of students? And the third and the last one, and this is perhaps most worrisome for me, that when you actually dig down in the results of these international tests, when you get to high-income areas, the students perform comparable to the rest of the world. But it's in low-income areas, especially urban areas, where the education performance is very poor. And I just wonder whether we, in fact, creating islands of very poorly educated people who are going to have a very difficult time trying to support themselves the rest of their lives.
Well, on your third point, I think we're already there. Dawn, are you still there? I didn't quite understand the second point you made about who doesn't care about the outcome of tests.
The students themselves, when they take these tests, it's just another thing they have to do, but really it's not that consequential for graduating or moving on.
Right, I get you. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That second point is actually a very good one because what we know about other nations is they do less standardized testing than we do, but when they do a standardized test, the stakes are equally high for the kids as they are for the teachers. You know, in our system, we've taken away a lot of the consequences for kids of doing poorly on tests, and we see the tests primarily as a way to judge adults. And this does create some perverse incentives in terms of we're giving kids a lot of tests. It may stress them out to take the test, but the truth be told is there's not all that many consequences for them if they don't do well.
Hmm. And what about parental accountability? This comes up so often. I don't know what you do about that. require parents to attend parent-teacher meetings on a regular basis. I just don't know.
You have to start with what the reality of daily life is like for many low-income families. I mean, you have parents working 2-3 jobs, and we see this all the time in New York City here where I live. So it's a tough task on schools and how to engage those families in their kids' learnings, but we cannot let schools off the hook. You know, I have read about schools that have changed their parent-teacher conferences to Saturday or Sunday mornings because they have found that that's an easier time for low-income parents to come, even though it's less convenient for the teachers.
Right.
And it's more convenient for the teachers to just stay a little bit late on a Wednesday night. So there's a lot schools can do. There are more and more schools that are trying home visits to families. You know, go to the home, talk to the parents in a place that's convenient and comfortable for them. And the point of a teacher or a principal visiting home is not just to report, you know, that junior's doing badly, but to just learn more about the kid and what his life is like. So I think oftentimes we finger point at parents without asking, what can schools be doing better to engage families?
Mm-hmm. Good one, Dana. Thank you very much. Because another email just arrived from Kathleen on the same point about parental accountability. Before we go to our next break here, let me read you this email from Chris, who's in the middle of reading your book, The Teacher Wars. And she says, I find myself recommending it to everyone I know. So how do you like that? She says, she says, a central issue that is raised in Ms. Goldstein's book is that not all cultures view teachers with the same level of respect. I recall a parent visiting day at one of Baltimore's elite private schools, at which one of our students proclaimed that she would like to be a teacher after she graduates from college. Her mother responded with, why would I spend all this money to send you to private school if you're only going to be a teacher? Is this attitude part of the problem?
Definitely. I mean, if you look at a country like Finland, the typical teacher is in the top 10% of their graduating class. And that's not true in the United States. So unfortunately, we don't have the prestige attached to it. And pay is one part of it, but it's more than pay. It's the sense that it's just not a culturally respected job. There's other things that people do for little pay that are more respected. So it's a big problem. I think we've often attacked the problem by saying, well, let's make it easier for the smartest people to become teachers. So a la Teach for America, let's say that if you're motivated to do it, you only have to have 5 weeks training. But that's actually the opposite of what other Western nations have done. They have found that the profession becomes more elite when you make it harder. You make it harder to become a teacher. You require teachers to spend 5 years studying before they do the job. You ask them to write a research-driven dissertation on teaching. And, you know, this is unsurprising to me. I mean, part of the reason why it's prestigious to be a lawyer or a doctor is because we know all of the hoops those folks had to jump through to become certified in those fields.
Dana, we'll take a break here, come back and talk some more. Dana Goldstein, our guest, author of The Teacher Wars, A History of America's Most Embattled Profession. You can join our conversation at 410-662-8780. Dan Rodericks here. A short break. You can tweet us also at Midday WYPR. Khalila did. She says, in high-income families, parents aren't in the school frequently either. That is a red herring argument used to victimize or blame poor people. If schools did things like student-led conferences, parents would be more inclined to come versus 10-minute drive-by meetings in the middle of the day.
I totally agree with the caller. I wasn't saying that parents need to be in the school frequently. I was stating that when we do ask them to be there, which is infrequently, we make it at a time that is possible for them to come, just like the caller or the writer said.
The tweeter. there's a tweet right after that from Melinda who says, in my experience, stay-at-home moms run PTAs, which correlates to some affluence because one parent is home all day.
True.
Yeah. Chris says by email, I'd like to see a teachers union that is ferocious in two areas, not just one. I wanted to fight for deserved benefits and conditions because the teacher is responsible for preparing the next generation. I also want to see a union that is just as ferocious at policing teacher incompetence and ethics. The few teachers that do bad work bring the profession down and they damage the learning experience.
Yeah, so this opinion is actually strongly supported by teachers themselves. Survey of teachers suggests that they would like their unions to do more to get bad performers out. And, you know, teachers and their unions agree about most things, but this is something where teachers themselves, you know, they know who's not doing a good job in their classes and their schools.
A call from Hedgesville, West Virginia. This is David on Midday with Dana Goldstein. Go right ahead, David.
Hey, Dan. Dana, I really like what you said. I think your book would be real informative to people that aren't in teaching. I just want to comment. My daughter is a substitute teacher, and she went over to the other county today because she feels that she needs to go over there since it's such a low-income area. She called at noon, and she just said two words when I picked up the phone, shoot me. And I just wanted to say that teachers really have to put up with a lot because of the family situations. You know, I've been out of high school for 50 years, and back then you didn't misbehave, but now you go in to teach, and most of your time is spent trying to keep the children in line, especially as a substitute, which is the worst job in the world.
Yeah, David, thank you for the comment. We hear that not only in the rural areas, but also in Baltimore City. Actually, hear it everywhere. That, you know, teachers have to deal with so many things in addition to teaching, as well as the behavior of children who bring a lot of, you know, problems from home to school with them.
Yeah, and there's nothing new about that. It's very easy to romanticize the past, but I found in doing the research for the history parts of this book that, you know, all the way back in the 19th century, the idea of what to do with disruptive kids. Do you keep them in the room? Do you throw them out of the room? What sort of punishments are appropriate? Suspensions, expulsions. This is a perennial debate. There's nothing new about it. And the idea that today's kids are worse behaved than kids in the past, again, there's no evidence for that.
I was going to suggest another subtitle for your book, The Teacher Wars, could be In Education, Everything Old is New Again. Right.
that's definitely true.
Dana, is another call. Sean in Baltimore, go right ahead. Welcome to Midday.
Yes, good morning. Good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call. I wanted to make just two observations and then ask a question. This is a very good discussion you're having. I sort of concur with the last caller in certain respects, in that teaching is a very difficult, though noble, profession. I taught for some time after getting out of undergrad, but I just couldn't stay with the profession because of having to police the classroom for most of the part of the day, and not having an opportunity to get my lesson done that I had prepared for all the night before. And I think in our country, we have such a sense of independence, and we don't have this sense of community, and we don't see the big picture. We don't see the need for educating even the least of these because their miseducation or lack thereof of education will have a lasting effect on our society as a whole. And I think in low-income areas as well, you have people who do not see the connection between education and success. One of my most difficult things to do in teaching in Baltimore City was to try to establish or try to instill within or help to instill within youngsters goals other than being a sports figure, a superstar rapper, or something that the odds were more in their favor, and so that leads me to my question: how do we incentivize people to enter teaching? And not only that, how do you incentivize students to learn?
Well, those big questions, Dana. I'll let you I'm interested in that first part. How do you incentivize the best and the brightest to go into teaching?
I mean, I think looking at starting salaries and also the opportunity to get raises in your 20s and 30s if you do well at the job in those early years, that's very important. The profession is very flat currently. There's not a lot of opportunities to be recognized for excellence and to take a leadership role. And what the caller talks about, difficulty getting to the content of the lesson when he was teaching because he was focused so much on discipline, reminds me of the fact, something I write about very much in the book, which is that a lot of teachers are not trained in the specific strategies they need to do just that, to manage a classroom on one hand, and on the other hand, to impart content knowledge. And we can restructure the profession so that novice teachers, like the caller was, who are struggling, spend more time learning from their experienced peers. Currently, that just doesn't happen in most schools. Those beginner teachers have no time structured into their day to learn from veterans, and veterans have no time structured into their day to train novices. So the profession needs to evolve to become much more collaborative. This idea that the teacher is alone in their classroom, the classroom's a black box, it's closed to scrutiny, you know, there's no sort of porous walls where we can watch each other work. That's not effective, and it's in fact not the way other nations structure their teaching profession.
That's very interesting. So I'm going to gather that you're not crazy about merit pay then, paying teachers, incentivizing teachers for better standardized test results, because that would probably undercut what you were just talking about, collaboration, collegiality among teachers.
Right. I mean, the reason why merit pay tied to test scores is a bad idea is that it focuses way too much attention on the tests and less on the critical thinking, bigger skills that we want kids to learn. But also, secondly, we've now had plenty of research done in places like New York City and Tennessee that have tried it, and it doesn't drive student gains. When you pay teachers more for student test scores do not improve. And what that suggests is that teachers are not holding back their true skills because they're angry about not getting paid more. Teachers actually need help and professional development to get better at their jobs. So I don't support merit pay tied to test scores, but I do support performance pay. And what I mean by that is if a teacher is really good at their jobs, not just as demonstrated by kids' test scores, but by observers coming into the classroom and talking to kids, talking to parents, it's clear that this is an excellent teacher. That teacher does deserve to make more money, but they shouldn't just make more money and that's it. They should be asked to take on additional responsibility in exchange, and that can mean helping train novice teachers at their school.
I want to take another call for you, Dana. Just a quick question. What do you think we should do about low-performing teachers? I mean, given the system that we have, okay, maybe high-stakes tests should be lower-stakes tests. Maybe we should, turn the heat down a little bit on all this. But you still have tests, and you will have some teachers probably new to it who maybe don't perform as well. What should you do with those teachers?
Well, teachers need time to learn their craft, and I believe that they should be given a couple years to learn what they're doing, and we need to provide them with support, with mentorship from a master teacher who they will watch work and see what works in their classroom. It's a very powerful learning tool for teachers to watch another teacher teach. But undoubtedly, if a teacher does not improve and is failing, they do need to be guided out of the profession. The fact of the matter is, though, we cannot fire our way to success in American education. There's 3.4 million people doing the job. We hire 100,000 to 200,000 new teachers each year. If we fired massive numbers of these teachers, there's no guarantee that the ones we replace them with would be any better. So we need to develop a culture of continuous improvement in our schools.
Daniel in Halethorpe, you got to be brief, Daniel, but go right ahead.
Got to be what? I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
Brief. We're near the end of our hour, so go ahead.
Okay. Well, here's the. I think a big question you're not answering, and I think it maybe is the critical question, and that is, what should we be teaching our children? When I graduated from high school, a man spoke, probably the best speaker I ever heard, having listened to a lot of convention speeches, and he said, "Are you an educated person? Can you entertain yourself? Can you entertain another person? Can you entertain a new idea?" That's what we should be preparing our children to do. Because if we think information is the answer, if we think just giving them more information, they can know their alphabet, they know the states, they know the capitals, et cetera, we're going to fail because information continues to increase. Consequently, we'll keep teaching less and less of the amount of information that's out there. My second comment is, I think if we would recognize that money is the answer, it can do two things that are critical to making the process better. One, reduce class size to a level where our
okay, Daniel, I ask you to be brief. One more time. One more, your second point quickly.
And the second thing is, if you pay teachers money, if you pay them good salaries, then you attract the best and the brightest.
Okay. Smaller class size, more pay, but define what our goals are. You deal with that in the book too. That's over all this time, that's what's been in flux. You know, what do we really expect from teachers?
Yes, and yeah. I would argue lifetime learning is what we want to be teaching our students to do, to be a lifetime learner.
Dana, I've enjoyed this, but, you know, there's like 6 or 7 more hours of midday we could get out of you. This is a great topic and well worth addressing again, so maybe we'll invite you back to midday.
I'd be pleased. Thank you, Dan.
Yeah, we really enjoyed the book and recommend it to our listeners who have an interest in public education, The Teacher Wars by Dana Goldstein. A History of America's Most Embattled Profession is published by Doubleday. Thank you again, Dana.
My pleasure.
We'll take a break here for lunch, brought to us today by Apples and Oranges Fresh Market, located at 1900 North Broadway. Applesandoranges.com is where you can find them online. We'll take a break here. We get the news and then the second hour of midday.